This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A woman's right to abortion was guaranteed by the Supreme Court in the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. But more recent Supreme Court rulings have limited that right. In 1989, in the case Webster v. Reproductive Health Services, the court ruled that states could place restrictions on abortions. Since then, hundreds of bills restricting abortions have been introduced in state legislatures and in Congress. Now one restrictive law, the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, is about to be challenged in the Supreme Court. The challenge is widely regarded as a test of whether the Supreme Court still upholds the principles of Roe. My guest, Catherine Colbert, is the lawyer who will argue the case against the Pennsylvania law in the Supreme Court. She went before the Supreme Court once before in 1985 when she challenged a similar abortion law and won. Colbert is the state coordinating counsel for the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project. The Pennsylvania abortion law requires minors to get parental consent or the consent of a judge. Wives must notify husbands. Doctors are required to inform women seeking abortion about potential medical complications. This must be followed by a 24-hour waiting period before the abortion is performed. The ACLU, along with Planned Parenthood, decided to ask the Supreme Court to review the Pennsylvania law. I asked Colbert if that was a difficult decision to make.
Clearly, it was one of the most difficult decisions we've ever had to make. In the normal course of things, ever since we've been litigating these cases since 1980, we've always won at the Court of Appeals. And this was the first time that a Court of Appeals in any section of the country had found that an abortion restriction was constitutional. And therefore, our clients were faced with a very difficult choice. They, however, discussed it very thoroughly and decided that because their rights had been eroded continually over the last several years, and because they expected further erosions, not only from the Supreme Court of the United States, but from the Court of Appeals, they couldn't guarantee that their rights would be any better protected if we had gone to the full Third Circuit. And therefore, they decided it was time to get the question of whether Roe versus Wade remains the law of the land resolved to enable American women to have it enforced if Roe exists and to exercise their choices in the voting box in the event that Roe is no longer the law.
So what's at stake here? If you win in the Supreme Court, what do you win? If you lose, what do you lose?
I think if we win in the Supreme Court, we will again have clarity on the view that the fundamental right to choose abortion remains part of our Constitution. Roe versus Wade was a decision in 1973 that not only forbid the state of Texas from banning abortion, but also restricted states from enacting roadblocks and hurdles or interfering with the ability of women to make the abortion choice. If we win, we can set about to enforce that right in the states, make sure that some of the 700 laws that have been introduced would never take effect. On the other hand, we don't expect that to happen. We think that the Supreme Court, having been packed by George Bush, is likely to further erode the rights as we know it or even go so far as to overrule Roe completely. And therefore, we have to turn to Congress to ensure that there's a uniform national policy to protect all women's rights.
Are you going into this thinking you're going to probably lose?
Well, yes, I think I am. I would like to believe that good legal arguments that justice and freedom win out because it's the right thing. Unfortunately, we are facing a court that has been stacked for two current administrations, stacked with judges who met the litmus test that they opposed abortion in order to join the bench. And their influence on the court has shifted from a minority to now a majority of the court.
So the justices can decide now to overturn Roe v. Wade or to just erode Roe v. Wade?
Well, clearly the justices have three options. They can directly overrule Roe, say it's no longer the law of the land. Second, they can erode Roe so significantly, essentially leaving it as a shell, but taking away any of its meat by finding that the states have greater powers to restrict abortion. Or lastly, they could reaffirm Roe. That third option is very unlikely. We don't expect it given the composition of this court, but those are the three options. It is in our view, unlikely that the court is going to directly tell us that they are taking away a fundamental constitutional right. It's not the style of this court. They're much more likely to take away the meat of the decision, to confuse people by saying they're doing something different than what they're actually doing, but nevertheless removing fundamental constitutional protection from women.
So you doubt that they're going to strike down Roe even if they uphold this law?
Well, I think that they are going to overrule Roe, but they will not tell us that that's what they're going to do.
Can you give us a preview of how you're going to argue this case, of what your strategy is going to be?
Well, clearly, we have to present to the court a defense of Roe versus Wade. But ultimately, this court has already acknowledged its hostility to that decision. Nevertheless, we think it's important to present the best defense that we can. We will do so not only in the written form, but certainly in oral argument, in explaining to the justices why millions of Americans rely on constitutional protections for their fundamental liberties. The additional thing I think we need to show this court is how these particular restrictions are really a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because what they do is they sound great, right? They sound very innocuous. They sound like they don't affect any woman's ability to actually obtain abortions. In fact, however, they operate in a very pernicious fashion.
For instance?
Well, let me give you an example. The 24-hour mandatory delay sounds very innocuous. Oh, who wouldn't want a woman to wait 24 hours before making an important decision? Well, in fact, the way it operates is it says that the delay has to occur from the time the woman obtains information discouraging abortion from the physician. That dialogue with the physician only happens at the very end of a long process. Most women have waited sometimes 4 to 6 weeks before getting an appointment with the abortion provider. She's also traveled 200 to 300 miles to find the abortion provider. Requiring her to wait an additional 24 hours makes her wait overnight in a strange location, pay the costs of a hotel, find friends in an area, reveal the fact she's having an abortion to a variety of other people, arrange childcare, essentially increasing her costs significantly. And for most physicians who don't perform abortions every day of the week, a 24-hour mandatory delay really results in delays from 7 to 10 days or longer. So what we're talking about
is, because you have to wait 7 to 10 days to get another appointment with
them. That's right. Because if the doctor doesn't do the abortion every day of the week, a 24-hour delay really means the delay until the doctor performs the abortion again, and that may be a week to 10 days later. You know, let me add something about that is that these regulations aren't intended to protect the woman's health. Most women have decided very firmly that they want to choose abortion before ever calling up an abortion provider. They've discussed it with their families. They understand what's at issue here. They've made a firm decision. But this is intended to discourage that decision.
Well, another part of the bill that you are challenging, of the law that you are challenging, says that a woman has to inform her husband that she is going to have an abortion. What are your objections to that?
Well, again, for the most women, we have no objections. Most women talk to their husbands or their partners about the abortion decision. In fact, if anything, it is men in this nation that are pushing for abortions in many instances, so that the discussion has been held and has been a fruitful one between the parties. What this law does is it forces those women who are unable to talk to their husbands, women who've been battered by their husbands, women who've been victims of marital rape, in fact, who've become pregnant as a result of rape by their husbands, to discuss the abortion option. And while, again, that doesn't sound so bad to some people, if it means risking your life because that husband really is vehemently opposed to the abortion decision, it means that women will either be forced to carry pregnancies to term or forced to face violence at home, an option which we find unacceptable in either case. And I think the other thing about husband notice, and most people understand this very, very clearly is that the legislature just doesn't trust women to make their own decisions. They're saying, we know better than you. And again, any law that says that the government knows better than women of the nation about personal and private decisions, in our view, is unconstitutional.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Catherine Colbert, and she will be challenging the constitutionality of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act in the Supreme Court. This is an act which restricts a woman's right to abortion. Colbert is the state coordinating counsel of the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is lawyer Catherine Colbert, and she will be taking the abortion issue to the Supreme Court. She will be challenging the constitutionality of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, which restricts a woman's right to abortion. This is considered to be a very significant case in which the Supreme Court will have to decide where it stands on Roe v. Wade. In your strategy in challenging the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, will you be mostly focusing on arguing that that this bill violates Roe v. Wade? Or will you be arguing for the moral right to abortion and the constitutionality of abortion? And which level will you be trying to reach the judges?
Well, Terry, I think we're going to do both. The first thing we've got to do is to make a compelling argument that this court must reaffirm Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. We need to explain to them how American women have relied upon this fundamental right and why its basic framework, that is, that states must demonstrate compelling reasons for interfering with women's decision-making, is one that has not only worked but has become an important compromise that balances the rights of women against other state interests. We then also must show that the other alternatives, that is, the standards of undue burden, the rational relationship test, which are the ways that the court could permit states to more greatly interfere with abortion, won't work. And lastly, we have to show how these particular restrictions interfere with the health of women. And if allowed to stand, may well send women back to the back alleys for their medical care.
When you present your case to the justices of the Supreme Court, are there specific justices that you're going to be focusing on, hoping that you can sway them to your side?
Well, certainly the entire strategy will be to convince a majority of the court that Roe ought to be reaffirmed. And when you're facing at least four justices who've already said clearly over and over again that Roe ought to be overruled, you're really have a very small audience for that point of view. And that's what brings me to the viewpoint that however persuasive my arguments may be, they're likely to fall on deaf ears. President Bush has packed this court with justices who are hostile to abortion, and therefore my arguments will be made, but realistically, we have to turn to Congress and to state legislatures to ensure that women's rights are being protected.
It sounds like you're walking into the Supreme Court thinking you're going to make this argument for history, but it might fall on deaf ears within the Supreme Court.
Well, I think that may well be true. But the thing is it's very important whether or not I ultimately win in this particular case for Americans to demand that Roe versus Wade remain the law of the land. Because the court and the justices can't have the last word on this question. They are only one body. They have guaranteed our rights since 1973. But Congress, by passing a federal statute that places the principles of Roe into law, could also be our guarantors. And so we must be realistic. I like to explain it to people. It's almost like a hurricane. We know the hurricane's coming. You feel very powerless in the face of knowing that the hurricane's on its way up the coast. On the other hand, you prepare. What do? You run the water. You make sure that you're ready to rebuild at the point that the court takes away the right or the point that the hurricane attacks. And I think that's what we're doing here. We're saying, I'm going to make the strongest argument I can, but if that argument falls on deaf ears, I'm going to make sure that the rest of the nation understands, A, what's at stake, and B, that they have the power to win it back by turning to Congress.
What could Congress do to guarantee women the right to abortion?
Well, currently Pending in Congress is the Freedom of Choice Act. It's a federal statute that would essentially put the principles of Roe v. Wade into federal law and would guarantee for all American women a uniform national standard, a uniform protection of their rights. The ACLU is pushing the adoption of the Freedom of Choice Act, and we would hope that this bill would be on the president's desk as early as this fall so that he would have the opportunity to make it the law of the nation.
What's your most vivid memory of 1985 when you challenged a Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act in the Supreme Court and won?
Well, that was a very important day for me. It was a very quite an honor to join the ranks of people who've argued before the Supreme Court, and the fact that there's so few women who have done that is a very significant event. Perhaps my most humorous memory is needing to go to use the facilities in the court and realizing that the only bathrooms for the lawyers who argue before the court were male bathrooms.
You're kidding, really?
And having to kind of make my way through the crowds because the women's bathrooms were down the hall. I'm hoping that this time around that has changed and equality has hit the facilities of the Supreme Court. But I think ultimate, besides that humorous memory, I think that the fact that that the advocate or the lawyer stands for so many other people, that you're really making an argument on behalf of people who rely on these precious rights every day, is a very awesome responsibility. And I think that ultimately that's one of the hardest parts of this job.
Catherine Colbert, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Great. Thanks, Terry.
Catherine Colbert will argue against the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act in the Supreme Court. The state of Pennsylvania will be represented by State Attorney General Ernie Priate, who declined our invitation to speak on the show. Nancy Myers is Communications Director of the National Right to Life Committee. The Pennsylvania chapter helped draft the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act and was instrumental in getting it passed. Myers told me she thinks pro-choice advocates are overplaying the impact this decision could have on the future of abortion.
NARAL and now the ACLU are doing a lot of political posturing on this issue. They're trying to rally their troops. They're trying to get a lot of media hype for it while we're continuing our efforts to stop abortion and remembering that every abortion stops a beating heart. It's our work is even more insistent. Another point to remember about Roe versus Wade and when Roe v. Wade is overturned, is that that doesn't automatically make abortion not available. What that means is then it goes back to the states. I think that's one of the things that NARAL and NOW and other groups have deliberately misrepresented that and made it seem as if once Roe were overturned, all of a sudden abortion's not around. All that overturning Roe would do was once again put the question back to the people of each state, and then would begin the long, slow process for pro-life groups of passing legislation. And the status quo is abortion on demand, with very few exceptions. I mean, things like parental involvement laws, no abortion funding in certain states. Other than that, there is abortion on demand, and that's something that the American people don't necessarily want. Americans are mostly in the middle on this issue. They're very much divided, but they're certainly moving in a more pro-life direction. And so they don't want the status quo, so any legislation we pass is progress. And that's going to be the long, slow work once Roe is overturned.
The pro-choice movement mm-hmm. being pessimistic about the Supreme Court upholding mm-hmm. the right to abortion mm-hmm. now is already drafting ideas for legislation in Congress mm-hmm. that would uphold a woman's right mm-hmm. to abortion. Are you planning on taking the battle into the Congress, too?
Well, we certainly will be battling their effort, which is the so-called Freedom of Choice Act. Now, the ACLU acknowledges that this bill would go much further than Roe v. Wade and would not allow states to regulate or limit abortion in any way, shape, or form. Parental notice laws would not be allowed. Things like conscience laws, laws that there are in most states that a doctor or nurse does not have to participate in abortion if they themselves are morally opposed to abortion, those laws would not be allowed. And so medical professionals would be forced to participate in abortion against their will. That's the impact of this law in Congress. We will certainly fight that, and it would be unwise of Congress to be considering passing something like that, because it's just so extreme. It would once again shut off the debate, just like Roe versus Wade shut off the debate.
Can you give us a timeline of what you see the next steps being in your fight to end abortion?
Certainly within the next few years, Roe versus Wade will be overturned. But the pro-life movement takes a long view on this. We recognize that it will be a long, slow process. And it's not only passing legislation, but it's changing hearts and minds. And we're also working in that arena. And so I can't give a timeline in terms of in 3 years, these states will have passed laws. The other side likes charts and graphs and maps. And we don't, because this isn't about politics or posturing. This is about human life.
What penalties would you like to see for doctors who perform abortions or for women who have them?
Laws before, no, women were not prosecuted before Roe versus Wade, and they will not be prosecuted, and nor will there be laws against women, because in every abortion, there are two casualties, one dead and one wounded. And so we definitely see a woman as another victim of abortion. So in that sense, there are never any penalties considered for women in these circumstances. That's one of the misconceptions out there. Certainly, for people who participate in abortion, the abortionists, most of the legislation being considered are strict civil penalties, so that a doctor really hitting an abortionist where it hurts. Abortion is a very lucrative industry, and these laws would fine them up to $10,000 for each abortion they perform illegally. And some states have considered criminal penalties against the abortionists, but no law has penalties against the women themselves participating in the abortion. I mean, in the women getting the abortion.
How long have you been in the Right to Life movement?
I've always been pro-life, just sort of viscerally. I think there's two sets of people in the pro-life movement, either people who were always thought it was wrong to kill unborn children, and other people who were swayed by the arguments in favor of abortion, but once they realized the reality of abortion, that every abortion stops a beating heart, they came to the movement. I've always viscerally been opposed to abortion, and I've been involved in the movement for about 5 years, and I expect to be involved in it for probably the rest of my life.
Nancy Myers is the Communications Director of the National Right to Life Committee. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.